In the last 2 weeks, we've covered two books of the Bible. Genesis was all about how God is sovereign Lord over all the nations, and the whole Abraham project was to restore the blessing of God's authority to the nations that are missing out on that. And Exodus was the story of God forming a nation from Jacob's descendants, liberating them from human rule, and establishing them as a nation under divine rule at Mount Sinai. And then they built a house where God could live among them and lead them and live for the honor of God. So we've done Genesis and Exodus. Tonight, we're going to attempt to cover Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua, which is kind of like four books. That gives us around about 20 minutes each. So, quick summary. Leviticus to Joshua is all about what it's like to be a people who are under God's leading. Leviticus tells how Israel was to live as a nation in God's presence in a way that would honor their heavenly sovereign. So Leviticus is all about the holiness question. Numbers answers the question, but what if God's people don't follow? What if they're disobedient? What if he wants to take them to the promised land, they won't go? Doesn't this wreck God's plan? Isn't the flaw in God's plan that if humans don't follow, it's never going to happen, right? And Numbers answers the faithlessness, the human faithlessness question. Deuteronomy deals with the question of the next generation. Okay, so that generation died in the desert. What happens to the next generation? The next generation needs to make its covenant commitment to God and follow him and be faithful to the faithful God who is faithful to all generations. Deuteronomy answers the generational question. And Joshua answers the question about territory. But there's already other nations that are in this land. There's Canaanites that are there. And so what is God going to do with them? And how will the land belong to the 12 tribes of Israel? That's what the book of Joshua is all about. Okay, quick summary. If you've got those four words, you've got those four books: holiness, faithlessness, generational, territorial. Those are the four books. That's a quick summary of where we're going tonight. So now we're going to dive into the book of Leviticus. I don't know how many of you have read the book of Leviticus recently. It's not easy to make an application of that for your life. The first seven chapters of Leviticus are all taken up with what it looks like to offer sacrifices to God. And I don't know how many of you own sheep or goats or cows, and I don't know how regularly you would kill one of those, or a bird if you don't have cattle, and offer this as a sacrifice to God. So it's kind of awkward to make sense of how to apply Leviticus. The next chapters, from 8 to 10, are all about how to consecrate the priests. And they had special garments and they had special ways that they had to operate. If you are not from the tribe of Levi, then this doesn't apply to you. The next few chapters are how to live clean in God's presence, but what we mean as Christians by clean and what they mean by clean don't always add up. Like if you happen to have shellfish tonight, then I'm very sorry, but you're not clean. If you touched a leper tonight, or if you buried somebody today, then you're not clean. There's a whole lot of things that make you unclean. And Leviticus, it's hard to make sense of all that stuff. At the heart of Leviticus, chapter 16 deals with what we call the Day of Atonement. The Hebrew word for that is Yom Kippur. And it's ultimately about maintaining covenant relationship with God. Because the New Testament talks about that, I think Christians have a better sense of how that works for us. Chapters 17 to 25 are all about how to live as a holy community under God. And then the closing section is a whole bunch of various laws about sanctions and redemptions and vows and all sorts of other things. So that's kind of a quick summary of Leviticus. And we dive into this Levitical law. My experience is that many of us are so hungry to make this stuff apply to us that we do kind of like mental or spiritual gymnastics with the text to try to make it work for us. So we think about sacrifices. And this is what I hear Christians saying. Well, Jesus is our sacrifice. He's the one who brings us forgiveness for sins. But in the Old Testament, before the time of Jesus, they used to offer cows and sheep and goats and birds and other things as a sacrifice for their sins. So jumping back from the New Testament perspective and then imposing Christian theology on Leviticus, you get the impression that the sacrifices must have been all about trying to get your guilt removed, as if that's what the sacrifices were all about. It's not. By and large, that is not what the Jewish people were doing when they brought their sacrifices. What they were doing was offering gifts to God. And many of those gifts are like food offerings for God. The NIV is right when it translates food offerings. What they were doing was not, when you had such a crisis of conscience, they thought, this is so bad, I better bring another cow. It wasn't like that. Every morning, the priests would bring an offering to God, and it was a food offering. They were giving God breakfast. Now, if Pharaoh was running Egypt, he would expect people to bring him food every morning. But Israel is not a nation like the other nations. They're a nation under God's kingship, but they still want to honor their sovereign every morning. So every morning they brought God a food offering. And then in the evening, they brought God the evening meal. So every morning and every, it's not about whether somebody was feeling really bad. It's actually about bringing an offering that honors God and recognizes him as our sovereign. So let's not just impose Christian theology on this stuff. I think we get so hung up about the whole issue of feeling guilty that we just are imposing stuff that was not how the Hebrew people were thinking about that. Now, I'm just going to take a break for a minute. I have brought a bunch of flowers tonight, and I am going to give this to my favourite person. This is for you.
Alan, what have you done?
Oh, yeah. Can any other guys relate to this? A gift might be because I've got a guilty conscience. I mean, that's possible, isn't it? Sometimes that happens. But if that was the way Robin responded every time that there was a gift for her, I'd be disappointed. That's not the essence of the relationship. The reality is, Robin, that this is Mother's Day this week, and we're going to be in church on Sunday. So I have brought you a gift to recognize you as a mother. That's what the gift is all about. So the gift isn't necessarily about guilt. And it's wrong for us to impose our Christian theology on the Old Testament like that. There were different kinds of offerings they brought as gifts to God. These are listed if you've got the notes there. There was a burnt offering, which is listed again and again and again in the early chapters of Leviticus. A burnt offering, the animal was brought, put on the altar, consumed by fire, and this pleasing aroma arose up into the heavens because the animal was being barbecued, burnt. This aroma, you can't take a cow and chuck it up to God. Here's a gift, right? So what they did was burned it, and the aroma rising to God was reminding God, we are your people, we recognize you, we are honoring you. Every morning we will rise and we'll honor you as the very first thing that we do in the day. It's a gift for God. Another kind of sacrifice was what they called fellowship offerings. With the fellowship offerings, the priest sat down to a meal at a table and ate the food that they were giving to God. They are on behalf of the whole nation. The priests are sitting at table with God. Isn't that a beautiful picture? There was a grain offering. They weren't all blood sacrifices. There were pouring out of libations. There was a whole range of different offerings that were given, and many of them were grain offerings that were being offered to God. And there was this thing that was called a sin offering as well. That was one of the different offerings. But even with that, we've got to be careful not to take our Christian theology of sin and put it back on the Old Testament people. A sin offering was brought whenever a person was unclean before God. I'll give you an example from Leviticus. This is about a woman having a baby. Well, the days of her purification for her son and daughter are over. She is to bring the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting a year-old lamb for the burnt offering and a young pigeon or a dove for the sin offering. So because the birth waters have made her unclean, because liquids regularly made people unclean in the Old Testament law, she's now unclean and she needs to make an offering for her cleansing. So this is called a sin offering. It's probably better to think about it as a purification offering, but that's how they refer to it. And so the priest will offer them before the Lord and make atonement for her. So whatever your atonement theology is, you're going to have to take this into account, that this is actually cleansing people before God. And then she will be ceremonially clean from her flow of blood. These are the regulations for a woman who gives birth to a boy or a girl. If she cannot afford a lamb, she's to bring two doves or two young pigeons. Whatever she's able to. The Old Testament is constantly including the people who aren't wealthy. Animals, any farmer's animals are quite precious. And if you couldn't afford that, you're still included. One for the burnt offering and the other for the sin offering, because there's two kinds of offerings to make here to God. And in this way, the priest will make atonement for her and she will be clean. Now, this was how Israel thought about what's clean and what's not clean, and the sin offering was for that kind of cleansing. This verse from Leviticus 12:8 is quoted in the New Testament in Luke chapter 2. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him, Jesus, to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord, and another law, to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what the law said, a pair of doves or two young pigeons, which is a quote from Leviticus 12. So apparently, Mary had to make a sin offering when she gave birth to the Messiah. I don't know any Christian theologian who would want to say, oh yes, but giving birth to the Messiah was sinful. It's not sin in the sense that we understand it. It's something that made the people unclean. Now, the Jewish community understood themselves as all living in the presence of God. That's the whole point of the Torah, the law. The whole, not just the rulers, not just the priests, but the whole nation is living in the presence of God. And when you come into the presence of God, you need to be clean. You need to be cleansed. So all these cleansing things were making themselves clean as they went into God's presence. If you've been working in the yard and you're coming in for dinner, you're going to wash, aren't you? Like you're unclean. And if you're going to sit in the presence of the rest of the family and eat together, then you need to wash. And in the same way, all of these Old Testament laws were reminding the people constantly that they were living in the presence of God. And so if they were going to join back in the communal feast at the presence of God, living in God's presence, then they needed to perform these things that would cleanse them. They're called sin offerings, but they're actually more of a purification rite that will make them clean so that they can live in the presence of God. So many of these Old Testament laws are simply reminding the people that they're living in the presence of God. Now, some of the Jewish food laws that are in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, I have absolutely no idea why God said, you can't eat that. Pork or shellfish or cobbler, because it doesn't have scales, right? So many things that God said you can't eat. And the only thing I know for sure is it's off the menu because God said so. I don't know why. Last week we had a connect group and I made some fruit bread to share for supper afterwards. One of the people in our group is allergic to walnuts. So we would normally put some almonds in instead, but we didn't have any of those. So we ended up with fruit bread with no walnuts in it because there was one person who couldn't have them. That's all I know for sure, is that God has said, this is off the menu. You don't do this in my presence. And the community goes, okay, if we're living in the presence of God, then we don't do that. all about the presence of God. Everything in the Old Testament law seems to me to be about living in the presence of God, or at least so much of it. God says, don't mix two different kinds of material together to make a garment, because when you put the garment on, you're not meant to be mixed in any way. You're meant to be living pure for me. You're meant to be one heart, single-hearted. And every time you put your clothes on, it needs to be a single strand, a single kind of thread, so that you're living in the presence, so you're reminded that you're living. So many of the laws make sense in terms of living in the presence of God, but let's not impose Christian values about sin on someone like Mary giving birth to the Messiah. That would be inappropriate for us to bring our thinking back there. So we might need to do a bit more work on our Christian atonement theology, because the priest was making atonement for Mary, but giving birth to the Messiah wasn't an evil thing to do. So why did she? Atonement has to do with being in the community, being included in the presence of God. So we're going to have to rethink, I suspect, some of our Christian thinking about sin and atonement and rescue. And we do need to be aware that we are constantly living in the presence of God, both individually and collectively. God is here in this room because you're here, because God is living in you. So we're in this community, and you probably washed your hands before you had dinner tonight, unless you haven't eaten. So we're probably clean from whatever work we were doing today, because that's what you do when you get together in community. And in the same way, as we live in community with each other, we want all the things that we say, all the ways that we treat each other, to be clean, communal things that we're sharing with each other, rather than sharing vitriol, stuff that would be harmful, stuff that's caustic, stuff that destroys community. You know, that stuff is inappropriate in the community of God. So it seems to me that what Israel was doing was more about modeling that through these basic laws. Hopefully, that's significantly richer than some of the thinking that we have done in the past. The essence of the message of Leviticus is devotion to the sovereign who leads the community. So the message that we hear again and again throughout Leviticus is this: I am Yahweh, your God. So on your side of this relationship, consecrate yourselves and be holy, because I am holy. If you are in relationship with me, then you are to be holy because I am holy. That phrase echoes through the book of Leviticus and on into the New Testament. I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt to be your God, the sovereign, the ruler, the one who's over you, in charge of your community. And therefore, you as a community need to be holy because I am holy. Chapter 19, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy because I, Yahweh your God, am holy. I love this verse 26 of chapter 20. You are to be holy to me because I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the nations to be my own. What God means by holy is not try to be better. It's be devoted to me. Israel's uniqueness was they were devoted to Yahweh, and God was devoted to them. He was the Holy One of Israel. So holiness actually at its heart means to be devoted, to be set apart as God people. So your life needs to communicate the fact that you are set apart for God. So you're not going to take on board questionable activities in your business world, things that are inappropriate, things that are harmful to the community, things that are destructive, gossip, you know, a whole range, stuff that's caustic to the community, caustic to each other, because we're the community that lives in the presence of God, and we're devoted to him. So we don't want to destroy the community that's under God. We want to contribute to the community, to be holy as he is committed to us. That's the essence of Leviticus. Right at the heart of Leviticus, chapter 16 is about the Day of Atonement. Do you know anything about that? Once a year, there was a special ceremony. And this ceremony involved two goats. The first one was sacrificed as a gift to Yahweh. The second one, the priest would take the goat, place his hands on it, and transfer the guilt of the people onto the animal. And then they would send this animal away outside the community into the wild spaces where the community wasn't. So in effect, what was happening was the guilt of the people was being exiled. So it's not actually the one that was slaughtered, it's the one that was exiled who was taking the guilt away from the community, which is why when Hebrews starts talking about this in the New Testament, it makes the point that Jesus was rejected by the people, first killed outside of the community because he was not accepted as the leader that God had sent them. So Hebrews does talk about some of these Old Testament things. And if you're talking to people who've got that kind of a background, then I guess that can be helpful language to use. You know who the Hebrews was written to, don't you? Probably to the Hebrew people. Okay, it's not really a trick question. To those who already knew all this stuff and were familiar with that. But when Paul was speaking in Athens, he doesn't go, oh yes, and there was all this Jewish sacrifice. You know, he doesn't go there because it's not appropriate for those people. And I suggest for most people in our culture, using the language of animal sacrifice is probably inappropriate for us in our culture as much as it was for Paul in Athens. So unless someone's got that understanding of the Old Testament, then maybe that's not the language that we use to talk about who Jesus is and what he achieved. We need to find fresh language to talk about the atonement and how God has made us one and how God has included us into the community that's under his leadership, and therefore why we should be a holy people that are devoted to God because he's devoted to, you know. So we've got to find fresh language for all of that. There are some texts in Leviticus that you would love, I think. Here's one of them from Leviticus 19. And God says, don't seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. Because I am the Lord, I'm in charge of this community. If you're bearing a grudge against someone who I love and include in the community, but you're trying to push them out, then you're at war with God over that one. So love your neighbor becomes part of the Old Testament law. And it's very obvious that Jesus said, that's the kind of community that we are to be as well. It's very much about maintaining community with God. The Day of Atonement was about maintaining covenant with God, maintaining community, being at one with each other. That's where the word atonement in English comes from, being at one. So because the community needs to be at one, anything that's going to drive us apart needs to be put aside, like the goat being sent down into the wilderness. That's the symbolism of the Day of Atonement. Yeah, God did not invent the idea of sacrifices. This was around a long time before Moses. This was in the world. And so take that into account. However you think about Old Testament sacrifices, just take that into account, please. It's not God's idea. Okay, the closing chapters of Leviticus then deal with the holy days, the feasts that they were to have several times a year. There were multiple feasts. There's Passover, Pentecost, weeks, trumpets, Day of Atonement, and tabernacles. They're all listed in Leviticus chapter 23. And for three of those feasts, everybody was expected to down tools, take a break, head down to Jerusalem. Some of them were a week long. You took the time off and you came in order to honor God. It's all about honoring God, recognizing it's harvest time, you honor God. When it's planting time, you honor God. When you remember what God did and bringing us out of Egypt, Passover time, we honor God. When we want to maintain covenant with God, we honor God. It's all about honoring God. And these are feasts. Do you know there's absolutely nothing in the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, about fasting? This is a religion of feasting. But we all get together to celebrate God. That's how it works. And in the Old Testament, fasting came later when stuff started to go wrong. So either people had personal things that went wrong, like David with a sick child, or later the whole community began to fast instead of feasting because the temple had been destroyed. There was no one for them to gather. So when one of the big feast days came around, they couldn't go feast and they started fasting and seeking God, saying, God, it's all wrecked. We've got nowhere to go. How do we honor you? The fasting came later rather than in the beginning. That's Leviticus. All right, going to try to cover numbers briefly before we break. Can anyone tell me how many tribes there were in Israel? Yes, 12 tribes. Can anyone tell me how many people there were in each of the tribes as they left Egypt? Numbers can. From Reuben, 46,500. From Simeon, who's the second son of Jacob, 59,300. The numbers from each of the tribe are listed here, which is why it's called the Book of Numbers, because that's how it starts, right? So if you actually want to know, you can add these up, and it comes to about 600 and something thousand altogether. Now, what we're talking about is not everybody. What we're talking about is the people who were able to serve in the army. Because what Moses is doing in the Book of Numbers here is taking a bunch of people who were totally disorganized slaves who'd just been told what to do and hadn't ever planned something in their lives, and he's structuring them, ordering them by families and clans and tribes, building this hierarchical structure like an army. So all the ones that are old enough to serve in the army, right up to, except for the old guys that are too old to serve in the army, and we're only talking males because of the nature of warfare back in those ancient days, right? So these are the number of males who are old enough to put in the army because Moses is structuring them to get ready to fight because they're going to have to fight for the promised land. That's why the Book of Numbers is full of numbers. Ultimately, the one who's leading them is God. So as it lists all these numbers, it talks about the tribe of Levi, who are the priestly tribe through whom God's leadership is coming to Israel. So that takes us through about the first one third of the Book of Numbers, until they're all ready and they blow the trumpets and set out to start moving on from the 2 years that they've spent at Mount Sinai building the tabernacle, doing all the stuff that God had asked them to do, and to head towards the promised land. Why did they blow trumpets? They didn't have walkie-talkies. Literally, the trumpet was the way that the commander could be heard in the distance. And so if you were one of the leaders of these groups, you needed to be able to recognize what that particular trumpet blast meant. There was one type of blast for attack. There was a different one for withdrawal. There was one for get up and go. There's one for head around. You know, all the different instructions were given through the only way that could be heard over vast distances, which were trumpets. The trumpets were the PA systems of the ancient world. And bear that in mind as you go right through the scripture, because even when we come to the second coming in the New Testament, we have the trumpet blast, right? It's like this, the announcement, the big vocal declaration that everybody can hear. It's an image that comes from these Old Testament passages. So they're all set to go. And one spy from each of the 12 tribes is chosen to go check out the land, and they come back with a report saying, wow, that land is utterly amazing. It's wonderful. But we don't think we can take it. We are not strong enough to do it. We can't. 10 of the 12 tribes say that the two that are not bringing that report are from the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Ephraim. Interestingly, those are the two tribes that become very, very big in Israel later on. So Caleb and Joshua from those two tribes bring a different report. But in the end, the people listen to these guys saying, you got no idea what you're up against. These fortified towns, they're well equipped. We got no chance of defeating them. And they refuse to go. And Numbers is asking us the question, what happens if people don't respond to God? This is supposed to be a nation under God's leading. What God says they do, right? But what if they don't do? Won't that wreck God's plans if people don't follow? If God's not the kind of king who's going to force himself on humanity, if he's going to rely on people to do as he asks, and they don't, doesn't that wreck God's plans? Won't it all fall apart? And God's answer to that question is, if you guys are too scared of dying to go, you're going to die anyway. So I'll just wait until you're dead. You don't have to go. You don't want to fight me. You don't have to. I'm not going to force you. But you're going to die anyway. So 40 years later, they all gradually died off in the wilderness. And God says to the next generation, okay, you guys going to go? So the answer to the question, what if people don't follow God, is it's going to take a lot longer, but God will continue to wait. The patience of God is just absurd. It's just like, how long is God prepared to wait? Unlike human rulers, I don't know how long King Charles will be king. If he's already, what, 75? Is that right? So if he's going to do anything, he's going to have to do it in the next 15, 20 years. He doesn't have long. And human rulers think like that. We've got to deal with that quick. But God's not like mortal human rulers. God's a different kind of ruler that goes, okay, you don't want to go? So sorry, it's going to take us a lot longer here. That's why it's been 2,000 years since Jesus was here, and not everyone is following him yet. Because God's not forcing himself on people. God says, you don't want to follow me? I won't force myself on you. I will wait. I will wait. I will wait. And God's program will come to pass. It will succeed because of the patience of God, the gracious, waiting patience of God. That's what will ultimately bring the whole earth under divine kingship once again, the way it was always designed to be in the beginning. I think that's what the book of Numbers is all about. It's giving us that answer. What happens if people are unfaithful? God's not unfaithful. His faithfulness will wait and will achieve what he purposed in the beginning. I'm going to take on one more little verse from Numbers before we take our break for tonight. And this is about a guy named Balaam. As Israel marches through Moab, the Moabites say, we can't defeat these guys. Our armies will not defeat them. We're going to have to get some other way to defeat them. What will we do? So what they decide to do is hire a prophet who will declare the demise of the Israelites, terrify the whole lot of them, and they'll turn around and leave. So they hire this guy who actually comes from the region of Babylon. This is the region that Abraham left. This is where the Babel builders were trying to take all the power from God. And I think Balaam is actually a polytheist. I think he believes in lots of different gods. And he believes, it seems to me that he believes that the Moabites have got a god over there, Chemosh. The Israelites have got a god over there, Yahweh. The Canaanites have got gods over them, the Baals, right? And so because Yahweh is the god over the Israelites, what he needs to do is listen to what this particular god is saying and declare that, because he's not the one who runs the world. It's like the gods who run their nations. So what is the god of this people saying? So he starts listening for what God is saying. And you know what? He hears it. God speaks to him. This is God speaking to a pagan polytheist. This is as crazy as wise men from the East who believe in that life is organized and run by the stars. They're astrologers, right? And God can speak to pagan Persian magi. God can speak to a Babylonian polytheist who believes in other gods. God, if these people are looking and listening to God, I am so encouraged by this text that God is more than able to reveal himself to anybody. We have these attitudes sometimes that unless a person's heart is absolutely pure, that God can't, because God's bigger than that. He's bigger than the limitations. That's not an excuse for being unholy. It's just saying God's bigger than the limitations that we try to place on him. So this guy gets this message, and what he hears is not the destruction of the Israelites. He says, the prophecy of one who hears the words of the Lord, I see him. This is like a prophetic vision that he's seeing. Not now. This is for later. I behold him, but not in the present. At some stage, a star will come out of Jacob. Now, Jacob, of course, is Israel. We're talking about the nation of Israel. A star is not a Hollywood star. We're talking about a regal star, a king, a leader. And I know that because his parallel phrase is, a scepter will arise out of Israel. So you know what a scepter is? If you watch the coronation, you do. Right? It's the ruler's staff. So a ruler, a king, will come from the nation of Israel. A scepter will rise out of Israel. And he will crush the Moabites are paying him to say this. Oh, staggering stuff. Edom will be conquered. A ruler will come out of Jacob and destroy the survivor. So he's time and time and time and time again, every time he starts listening for God, this is the message that he gets. He declares that a ruler is to come, a king is to come. This nation will succeed. This nation will enter the land. This nation will receive the kingship. There'll be a king who represents God who will rise. And just like the foreign prophet from the east declared this message, Matthew says that the Magi from the east followed a star, saying, where is the one who is born the King of the Jews, this one that's been proclaimed from so long ago? Where would we find him? So there's this message that runs right through Scripture, even from other nations, even from the pagan prophets, that God's kingship of the world will be brought through the star who was promised. Well, I don't know whether they ever paid this prophet to say this stuff or not. Seems like he keep upping his fee, and eventually the Moabites gave up on him and said, this is never actually going to work. And they devised another scheme. If you can't corrupt God to get him to curse his people, then perhaps you can corrupt the people so that they get cursed by God. So the Moabites invite the Israelites to come to their party and worship their gods, and the Israelites get involved with the pagan festal activities, and there's a whole lot of sexual immorality and pagan celebrate, pagan feasts. So Israelites are actually being corrupted by the Moabites so that God's anger will strike them. And later in the book of Numbers, we discover that Balaam, the false prophet, gave them this advice. So once again, the question in the book of Numbers is, even if God wants to bless his people, if they're unfaithful, won't that wreck the whole thing? And God does have to deal with them, and God deals with them extremely severely, actually, in this particular occasion, but they aren't destroyed. The promise of what God has purposed remains because of God's faithfulness. So even when his people are unfaithful, and it hurts them, God remains faithful, and God's purposes are fulfilled. For me, that's the message of the book of Numbers.
Did you just say that Balaam was the one that gave them the message to corrupt the...
Yeah. That comes up later in the book, 31:16. When they did that, they were following Balaam's advice. We're not told that in chapter 25. We'll learn that later. All right, coffee break time.